Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio. The Fourth Estate is RCR's newest discussion panel, where our hosts and guests cast a critical eye over the New Zealand media. Today's host is Alistair Harding, with his panelists David Harvey and Catherine Enos Carter. It's time for the Fourth Estate.
Good afternoon and welcome to this week's edition of the Fourth Estate, our Reality Check Radio weekly roundup of the media's wins, losses, gaffes and banter. My name is Alistair Harding and I'm your host for today's show for the 5th of April 2024. And on this week's show, we'll be talking about journalism schools, TVNZ's new political editor, Guion Espiner's new role at RNZ, and the latest attempt to indoctrinate our kids with what has been termed as media literacy in this country. But before we get into all of that, our panel today. First, we have a former judge and blogger who specializes in internet and media law. But wait, there's more. He's also a former mastermind champion. Welcome, David Harvey.
Thank you, Alistair. Good morning.
And also today, we have someone I find forever fascinating, a management consultant with a resume covering governance, public administration, public sector reform, and policy development from a career that spans the entire globe. And not only that, she's an incredible artist, Catherine Enos Carter. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Alistair. Thank you for acknowledging the various careers.
Okay, so let's get straight into it. Leading the Fourth Estate today, we have the story about how journalism schools are coping with the recent media industry cuts, particularly in this country at News Hub and TVNZ, but also around the world, where I note the international publication, The Press Gazette, estimates there's been at least 8,000 job cuts made in the UK, US and Canada alone in the past year. And then there's also the steep decline of trust in the media all over the world. But never fear, the New Zealand Herald has been on top of the story this week, and they report that across the country, our media schools aren't too concerned. They say that the enrollment numbers are down, but they're still turning out all the young lovelies we need to read the government's press releases. Sorry, I mean the news. David, you can kick us off. If the decline of the news media is a reflection of the changes in how we consume our news, isn't the decline in journalism school enrollments just a reflection of those very same changes?
I think it certainly is. I've had a theory for a long time that the news media in this country just do not understand the digital paradigm environment that we now occupy. And they seem to be insisting upon carrying on with the business model that has operated successfully for them for many, many years. But everything has changed. I think in some respects, there are two ways of entering the journalistic stream. One of them is to undertake the formal education process, which is what the article is about. And the other is to get boots on the ground and to go into a newsroom and start as what used to be called a cub reporter, if you're going to use the old style nomenclature, and learn by doing, and under the not too gentle hand of a sub-editor who will call out your mistakes. But it seems that as long as you can fit in with the model that the journalistic schools are putting forward, then you may have a career in journalism in the future. One of the problems that I have about all of this is, unfortunately, many people these days don't know how to write. And an example occurred, I think, yesterday in the New Zealand Herald, where there was an article about a person on the Auckland City Council who was working remotely from Queensland. That person was not named in the article. There was only one person, and yet that person was described in the third person plural pronoun, they, rather than he or she. Now, I can understand that there may have been a desire for anonymity, but really there is no excuse for that sort of bad grammar that is elementary. And I would have thought that the first thing that you need to do if you're going to go to journalism school is learn how to write a proper English sentence and learn how to parse one. And it's either the writer or the sub-editor, or probably both, who have been found wanting in that respect. It grates.
Your thoughts, Catherine?
Yes, well, I think, David, I agree with you about not being able to write. There's numerous articles that pop up on the internet that just infuriate me for the lack of ability to write credible sentences, but also all the grammatical and spelling errors. I'm one of those people that gets irate about such things. But we keep having language experts telling us that it all doesn't really matter. Grammar and spelling is not important. Anyway, but I think just reflecting a bit more on what you're talking about, the journalism schools, it might appear to us that faith in journalism is declining, public trust in the media is declining, but I think rightly, I think you're pointing out that the model that's been operated for decades by what we call the mainstream media or the legacy media has perhaps now become ineffective. And you're making the point that the media don't seem to understand how things have changed. But I think also the public really doesn't understand key facts of how things have changed. And one of them is that almost insidiously over the last few decades, we've gone from a concept of journalism as reporting involving things like accuracy, credibility, balance, and integrity. And what's happened over a period of time, particularly in television, is that we've gone away from all that. Now it's become about presenters interviewing each other and telling us their opinions and lecturing us even on what we should think. So there's been a significant change in the way that the news is presented and the way that the news media operate. And I think the public, when you're talking about lack of trust, are still getting to grips with this change. And I think a lot of the general public are probably get as furious as I do and want to throw things at the television when you've got so-called political commentators who are actually just communications graduates lecturing us about what we should think.
Well, not just journalists, prime ministers as well.
Well, yes.
And that's just a reflection of how many different sources of news we have these days, is it not? That we have all these different ways of getting to the news, that it's not just TV1 and News Talk ZB and the New Zealand Herald that give us our news anymore.
Yes, that's right. But in some ways, I can understand why the journalism schools are not phased about what might appear to be a decline in traditional journalism, because what's also happening, and again it's been a bit behind the scenes, is that journalism has also been, or journalists have been, moving into other spheres, and one of them is educating an army of NGOs and other activists about how to operate in the media. And for instance, we've seen that with the establishment and the operations of the Disinformation Project, who've been providing training to the media on how to present and counter so-called disinformation. otherwise known as censorship. So I think the journalism schools probably know that journalism has a future in all sorts of directions that are not just about faithful reporting and presenting the news. And I think, you know, some of these things are quite insidious and alarming, and we can talk about the deeper aspects of that.
On the next story, you know, I think a lot of what you're talking about there is this decline in trust in the media. And one of the stories this week, there's a sort of a tinge of distrust in it. The story about the new political at TV, the political editor at TVNZ. Her name is Maiki Sherman, and she's the first woman Maori political editor for TV One News. She says she's going to be a political editor for all New Zealanders. That kind of reminds me of how Jacinda Ardern promised to be a government for all New Zealanders, except the ones she couldn't vaccinate. But while Maiki says she doesn't want to be seen, I quote, boxed in as a Maori woman who only has a Maori agenda, all the press information about her seems to focus on those things. So what can we really expect from her? And I guess also I wonder if the position of TVNZ's political editor is even as relevant as it once was.
I was a little bit fascinated with all of this. I must say, when Jessica Mutch-McKay announced that she was going to go and work for a corporate, the appointment of a new lead political editor or political reporter was of interest. And I saw Benedict Collins and Maiki Sherman as being the two real contenders. And of those two, I thought Maiki Sherman probably had it, because Benedict Collins, I think, wears his heart on his sleeve a little bit too much and smirks his way through his stories. I have no difficulty with Maiki Sherman as a reporter. Yeah, she probably puts more of a left-way spin on her stories, not completely objective, but is it necessary for anybody to emphasize that she is the first Wahine Māori political editor for TV One? That is completely irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. The question that I ask is this the best person for the job that they have? And presumably she is, otherwise she wouldn't have been appointed. I'd hate to think that she was appointed for any other reason than that she was the best person available.
Catherine.
Well, I think, you know, it's slightly disingenuous, really, to claim when you've been identified as a person who is being promoted as a Māori woman journalist, and if you've been associated in the past with much of that, of reporting that relates to Māori issues, can you then turn around and say that you want to be a reporter for everybody? The very fact that you kind of have that association in the public mind, you know, how much does that come into it in terms of appointment? And I, like David, would like to think that she was judged the best person for the job, and not that appointment had a political or some kind of agenda motivation behind it.
Okay, so what do we know of her reporting style and her reporting until now? Has there been any political agenda to any of it?
Well, I'm just thinking about how some of these journalists who, you know, it hasn't been not noticed that when there are issues associated with particular ethnicities, I'm thinking about Waitangi Week, the kind of reporting that was done then. Perhaps it's unfortunate that some of these Māori reporters kind of get labelled with the general approach that TVNZ and other media platforms have taken, where the standard approach now seems to be that whatever the issue, you report the statement of what that issue is. You give quotes from politicians about half a minute's coverage, and that may be an explanation of policy action or whatever. And then you go to extended coverage and interviews with people who are complaining about that or in opposition to it or say that they're going to be adversely affected by that. And so we saw that with the reporting that was taking place during Waitangi Day and before and afterwards about the impact of some of the government's measures. And there was extended interviews of that nature. So I think perhaps it's a bit unfortunate that some of the Māori journalists start to be identified with that kind of approach, whereas it's more a platform or a media, a whole media approach, rather than they themselves as individual journalists.
The trouble with television is that you can actually see the commentator, which means that you're not only hearing the words and also listening to the tone that is being put forward, but you can actually visibly see the body language. Now, I must confess that Ms. Sherman does very well in generally presenting a fairly objective and neutral front to the camera. And she does work the camera very, very well indeed. I will say that for her. There are occasions when there might be a little bit of tone or perhaps even a raised eyebrow, which could be subconscious, which would seem to suggest that perhaps a slightly different point of view is being put across other than the words. At least she's not like Campbell, who wears his heart on his sleeve and rabbits on ad nauseum and really doesn't give us much fact but tells people's stories. I'm not interested in hearing people's stories. I'm interested in facts, but then that's what I've done for most of my life.
But this is this will be a position which is the centre point of the co-governance debate for the next few years while she's in that role. Can we expect to hear both sides of that? Because just opposing the Maori point of view shouldn't disqualify people from actually being part of that discussion, should it?
No, of course not. Both views have got to be put forward in the interest of balance. It's elementary. I don't know that you will get balance, because balance doesn't seem to be the thing these days. And indeed, there are some outlets which would seem to suggest that they want to be known for taking a particular position on an argument. And there have been occasions when the various media outlets under the Stuff umbrella, as well as those under NZME, will not actually take a story that runs counter to the sort of orthodox view, if I can put it that way. So as far as the co-governance thing is concerned, frankly, I don't think that it's going to be an issue, not under this government anyway. But I think it will continue to be an issue, but not one that is as sharp a focus as it was before. People like Willie Jackson will try and breathe some life into it. But I think there are other things that are occupying people's minds these days.
I guess a lot of these conversations are about the trust in the media and our glazed views on it at the moment in the wake of everything that we've been subjected to over the past few years. And talking about the response to that, Guion Espinner is making a play for some of that lost trust by launching a show on what many consider to be our country's least trusted news outlet, Radio New Zealand. He's launching a new show which is being marketed with imagery that's obviously attempting to make us think of 60 Minutes, but there's a twist. He's going to do interviews without editing. So I quote, "It's going to be in-depth and unedited," which he tells us is really, really, really important. I quote again, "I think that's really important at a time where trust in media has been declining. We're saying what you see is what you get," says Guion. "We're not going to manipulate this." David, Catherine, he's giving us 60 Minute style marketing. He's giving us an unedited 30 minute show. That stuff sounds to me a bit like a gimmick, but he himself does, let's be fair, bring a level of skill as a journalist that's pretty impressive. But will it get us any closer to less ideology and more truth in our news?
What you see is what you get. An unedited conversation? Give me a break. I have seen, and indeed I have, manipulated conversations by what is known as cross-examination. And that, after all, is what journalists do. In fact, they should do. Not many of them actually know the true art of cross-examination, but there it is. But you can direct a conversation in any way that you want. You can make it north, south, east, or west. It doesn't matter. To suggest that what you see is what you get, you're going to get the unedited version. No, you're not. You're going to get the version that Guyon wants you to hear, based upon the questions that he is going to ask and the signposts that he is going to put up and as the conversation proceeds. That's what cross-examination is all about. You have a destination that you want to reach, and you can do it by any number of means. Come on, really?
But he does have a very good reputation as an investigative journalist, does he not?
Well, do any of the current media deserve a reputation as an investigative journalist? Quite frankly, I haven't seen investigative journalism for years. It seems to be an incredibly short supply. And like you, I'm entirely cynical about whether we're going to see the unedited version or the what you see is what you get. We haven't seen it for years, so I'm not convinced that we're going to see it now.
Knowing a little bit about editing myself, I kind of think that it's either going to be an incredible bore or just a couple of people who enjoy each other's voices talking to each other.
Well, we've seen so much echo chamber stuff, and we're continuing to see it all the time. And it's right through the media. It's through publications like The Listener, which I always describe as the bugle, the government's bugle for the middle class.
Hang on. I do a column for The Listener every fortnight. Be careful there.
I look forward to it, David. I'll particularly note it now. but I think, the echo chamber phenomenon, I think what we are likely to see is more echo chamber stuff. It's people talking to each other who are generally in agreement. We might see a little bit of manufactured debate, but I'm not hopeful that we're going to see real balance and real journalism as we used to understand it.
It strikes me when you say that, though, Catherine, that a lot of this is just the way that the media landscape is changing and how there are lots of different ways of consuming news these days. And in fact, I'd even go so far as to say that everyone with social media, every one of us has become a part of the media. And so then what this becomes a topic about is also how we consume it. And I believe, David, you've got a few thoughts on this one about media literacy. And in particular, we were looking at some stories about lateral reading. What does this mean? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, media literacy is a term that has developed. But I would start by saying it is not new. But I'll just give you a very brief outline of what it is. Given the proliferation of sources that there are for information, media literacy is about identifying reliable information that you can make informed decisions based upon, and that briefly is it. Now, to pick up on the point that I made a few seconds ago about the fact that it isn't new, I started teaching law and information technology at Auckland University back in 2000, so 24 years ago. And at that stage, there were a number of sources of legal information that were available on the internet. Some of them you had to pay for, like Lexis and Westlaw. Others were free to air, like the Australasian Legal Information Institute and so on and so forth. But there was a lot of other free legal information that was available. And I used to start my lectures by saying, on the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog. And that applies as much to information. You can get dog information as well as reliable information. And so what I developed was a way of various tests that you could apply to identifying reliable legal information. I mean, let's face it, if your legal information is rubbish, then you're going to be making some bad decisions. So what I was doing, in fact, as far as the legal information scene was concerned, was developing some rules for what is now known as media literacy. Okay, so fast forward to 2024. What media literacy has become is you need to be able to identify the reliable sources of information that we tell you about. So rather than using your own brain to work out the reliable sources of information, rather than using your own ability as a critical thinker, rather than exploring a number of options before deciding which option you're going to rely upon, you follow a particular path. Now, that means that you are going to run into an issue where you have groupthink as being the accepted version, the orthodox view. The heterodox view that you might get from exploring a number of sources means that you become a heretic as far as the orthodox view is concerned. And once again, we're back into this information, misinformation, disinformation, malinformation routine. It's the same story, but it's wearing a different coat. Nothing wrong with media literacy. Nothing wrong with the idea of examining your sources, checking them out, making sure that they're reliable, make sure that the same story appears in a number of different and independent places before you make your assessment. No problem with that at all. That is good critical analysis. But to say, you know, there is just one sole source of truth, haven't we been there before?
Yeah, David, I agree with that. I think that this whole idea of media literacy, it's very interesting in the context of misinformation and disinformation, because at its simplest, it seems to me to be, you know, you could take it as a basic process for cross-checking. That's what it's about, verifying the credibility of information. But what's crept in now, and this is what I think is so disturbing about this whole misinformation, disinformation stuff, is that the word credible now is associated with the stamp of authority. And what's really disturbing about all this is that the misinformation concept is based on an idea that there is such a thing that can be identified as truth, and everything else is misinformation. And that's that was actually in the abstract that I read when the Disinformation Project was first established, that they're starting with that concept. And so, and this is creeping into all sorts of things now, and it's disturbing in a number of ways, because putting that stamp of authority on things is very important as a psychological tool, because we know from, you know, early psychological experiments back in the 50s and 60s that 65% of people are programmed, basically, or attuned to following the instructions of those who they perceive to be an authority, whatever that authority is, and are not don't necessarily stop doing that when that authority becomes malevolent. And so if you're hooking back, you know, this notion of truth and everything else is misinformation, and you're hooking that back to the notion of the stamp of authority, it all becomes very disturbing. And of course, what was disturbing about, you know, this goes right back to when I think the public was confronted with that probably for the first time, when Jacinda Ardern said, "We are your single source of truth." And things have gone on from there. So I was interested in a quote from Mike Benz on this. And again, it relates to the point about training in journalism or these journalistic approaches. And I was talking about how this is now being used to educate a whole lot of NGOs or non-government actors who are actually being used or contracted to be involved in education and training and other related activities. So Mike Benz was talking about marshalling a mercenary army who are in charge of your kids' education and training a generation of censorship professionals tied to the teat of government-backed censorship operations. And I thought that was a pretty good quote because, you know, we are seeing a noticeable trend in this that NGOs are being contracted to undertake these operations. And part of educating about media literacy is hooked back to it's all based on credible sources which are linked back to basically government or authority-based sources, then, you know, it's all going down a very disturbing path.
Talking about that, there's a promotion going around at the moment for a so-called climate disinformation school. It's been started up to tackle so-called climate change disinformation. It's led by a guy, I went onto the website, it's led by a guy wearing a Sega game t-shirt, so I suppose that's to make sure that we all know he's young and hip to all the online ways of the world. Do we really need this stuff? Is that an issue where it's needed perhaps, or is there a line in the sand that we're just crossing when we start up these so-called disinformation schools?
Well, looking at that particular climate disinformation night school and the guy who's running, who wears the Sega t-shirt. His name is there on the website. His name is Byron Clark. And he has written a book called Fear. And that was a very interesting piece of work because in many respects, it told us more about Byron than it actually told us about the subject. And it told us more about his fears rather than the fact that a lot of fear was being engendered from online sources, because I think that was his theory. The only problem that I had with Byron, and forgive me for being a little bit particular about this, but if you're making an assertion of fact, back it up. Very, very few resources, very, very few footnotes, very, very few external references where I could go to check out whether or not there was any validity in this. I mean, basic media literacy in action. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, there was an awful lot of speculation. There was an awful lot of Byron's own particular issues, if I can put it that way. It's about as nice as I can put it, than anything else. And to see that he is involved in this climate disinformation night school causes me some concern, because the first thing is that this whole idea of disinformation or misinformation or whatever, that is points of view that don't conform to the orthodox line, has shifted from COVID and now it becomes part of the climate thing. Now, you know, forgive me for sounding a little bit silly on this, but we've been having climate change since the beginning of history. You know, there have been ice ages, there have been mini ice ages, there have been hot spots, there have been this, that, and the other, and it's been going on and on and on forever. Instead of sort of, and the thing is that the climate change these days is a sort of umbrella word, a grab bag word. Oh, it's raining, it must be climate change. Oh, really? Is that what causes rain? I always thought that it was evaporation and condensation. But no, it's climate change. And the floods are climate change, and everything is climate change. Now, what in fact they are saying is we're concerned about human accelerated effects upon the climate. Not climate change. But whether or not, you know, we're putting too much carbon dioxide out into the atmosphere, which we probably are, which is going to create a greenhouse effect, which it probably will, which will dissipate in the fullness of time, because these things are cyclical. Let's face it, Mother Earth is a hell of a lot bigger than any of us little ants running around on it, and it is going to continue to be that way. It is part of the cycle. But having said that, now that of course, that point of view is disinformation. You know, that's naughty. That is heresy. But you see, the thing about it is that if you don't conform to the orthodox line, then you're into disinformation, you're into opposition, and you're probably associated with the far right or something of that nature. And that seems to be Byron's particular point of view. And as far as I'm concerned, he doesn't, and the climate disinformation night school doesn't fulfill the tests of media literacy, as far as I am concerned. Another particular thing, I don't know that it's associated with the organization that is in fact sponsoring it, but some of these organizations like Fact Aotearoa and a few other outfits will not allow their activists or people who are involved in it to be identified. So you are unable to find out who is behind a particular point of view. You're unable to verify where the information is coming from because these people are behind a veil of secrecy. Oh, no, we don't want to reveal who we are because we're afraid of being trolled. Well, I'm sorry, if you're going to go out to the public arena, better be ready to have your hat picked around.
One of the other things, though, that I think about this is that they are bringing these discussions out into the space. Yeah, sure. Their main point really is that disinformation is a deviation from the official narrative. But what they're actually also doing is making us all think about what is disinformation, how we should be consuming media. You know, all of those things actually are important, and it's making us actually discuss them, isn't it? Isn't it making us actually think about why these things are so important, why freedom of speech is so important? Their point may be to actually try and shut down freedom of speech and make sure that there is only one single source of truth, but they're actually also making us think about why these things are so important.
You don't want to be known as a critical thinker. That's the only problem. You're stepping outside the, you know, you're stepping outside the boundaries. You're being an individual, which of course is anathema to the groupthink collective mentality of the left. And most of this stuff is being driven by the left. It's just another form of control.
But it's still teaching us why these things are important, right? And so there will be a shift once people start thinking about that.
Oh yeah, oh sure, but yeah. but heaven help you if you express a contrary point of view.
Hmm. And I think that's the point, that these campaigns or measures about so-called countering disinformation are basically campaigns of imposing groupthink, and as David said, it's kind of the imposition of a new orthodoxy, or what we might call the current narrative or the official narrative. So it's associated with putting down any counter to that kind of imposition of groupthink or group norms. And I think, I mean, I take your point, Alistair, that maybe it is helping us to think about these things. And the more people hear these terms, it's coming in. You know, I was reading something on the internet this morning, and the words misinformation and disinformation are so creeping into the language now. On one hand, as you say, yes, it's making us think, but I think some of the topsy-turvy psychology that's in behind this is actually quite disturbing, and I feel for the general public trying to make sense of all this and trying to discern what is actually misinformation or just the imposition of the current narrative.
Well, part of the problem that I have, Catherine, with the use of the words disinformation and misinformation is that They're thrown around, that's misinformation, or why is it misinformation? Tell me what's wrong with the particular point of view that I've expressed that makes it misinformation, or why is it disinformation? No, those terms are never expanded upon. You're never actually told why. I mean, I loathe the words. They have far too many syllables in them for my liking. And there are some much better words, like misinformation is speculation or rumor.
Yes.
Disinformation is lies. Simple. You know, call it what it is. That's a lie. Disinformation, that's some psychobabble word that's been dredged up by some academic who's decided to write a PhD where they describe an old phenomenon with new words.
And it's turning these words into weapons to shut people up, isn't it? If we move on to the media stories of the week, there's a good segue into this one. The first story is about Princess Kate. And there's been conjecture over the past couple of weeks about Kate using a body double. And the media is crying foul. They're using those words. They're saying it's just a conspiracy theory. But let's untangle some of that. She did go missing for a long period of time. And there were endless denials about anything strange happening. But then she was also caught manipulating her photos, and that's been proven. And then probably because of that, when she announced her cancer diagnosis on video, that video came into question as well. And now the BBC's reporting that the so-called conspiracy theorists are responsible for claiming that a new photo of her out and about and looking healthy is not really her. And their proof is, wait for it, the media says it's her. That's the proof. I say that they're responsible for the lack of trust everyone has in them. Perhaps the burden of proof is on them these days to convince us of the truth, not the public, who've had enough of all the gaslighting.
Of course it is. The burden of proof is always upon the person who's making the assertion. That's a fundamental proposition. It underpins our criminal law. If you say something is so, then prove it. And the thing about... I mean, I classify phrase conspiracy theory as used by the media in the same way as I classify misinformation and disinformation. It's a silly term that really is very, very sinister if you look at it realistically, and is completely wrong as far as this business about Princess Catherine and whether or not it was her and so on and so forth. It's not a conspiracy theory, for heaven's sake. It is speculation. It is what people do. They're trying to explain something that they can't really understand. Why is Princess Catherine not here? Well, it could be because she's gone on holiday, or she's separated from William, or she's had an argument with the king, or something like that. It's all speculation. But of course, the thing is that you get a story like that on TV1, and it gets classified as a conspiracy theory. Really? You know, who are these?
But they never say what the conspiracy actually is.
No, of course not. You know, I mean, when I think about a conspiracy, I think about Cassius and Brutus trying to assassinate Caesar. That's a conspiracy.
Have you seen the photograph in question?
Well, the thing about it is, Alistair, that once upon a time, photographs didn't lie. Photographs were a cast iron piece of proof. Now that they can be manipulated, of course, you don't know where it is. But if somebody takes a photograph with their phone of Kate, puts it up on the internet, good on them. I'd say that's pretty reasonable. But prove that it's been manipulated. Now, they did prove that the photograph that she had with the kids had been manipulated in a couple of minor ways. Heaven's sake. A little dust up on the sleeve or something like that on the way the hand works. Goodness me, that means that the whole thing is completely invalid. Stupid.
But the reason I bring up the photo is because I took a look at it and it really doesn't look like her. So I can completely understand why people are speculating on it.
But that's it, Alistair. You use the word speculate. Yeah, that's what it is. It's speculation. It ain't a conspiracy.
Okay, talking about... Oh, carry on, sorry, Catherine.
No, I was just going to introduce a bit more lightheartedness to this. I've been thinking about the media recently, particularly about the mainstream media, but all aspects of the media. But I think you made a point before about, you know, the people are becoming involved in media now. And I was thinking about, you know, how the people might convey their opinions of the media to the media. And I was thinking about, you know, the media, you know, you have the annual media awards, and the media is very fond of awards and noting awards. And so I thought we could create some media awards. So I came up with a list of about five or so. And when I thought about these, there's been some doozies in the news over the last week that would qualify for some of these awards. So my list includes the High Level Hypocrisy Award, and you know, a historian friend of mine once said, "Never underestimate the usefulness of hypocrisy." You know, it's always very good for politicians to accuse other people of what they're doing themselves. So we could have an award for that. Then we could have the Abundant Bias Award, and I don't think I need to explain that. Then we have the Creating Community Hysteria Award.
Oh, that's a good one.
And you can think of some good examples of that. My mind goes to the Posy Parker stuff straight away. And then we've got the Woke Sympathy Award. And in recent times, we've had a number of those, particularly when people who put themselves up for public office fall off the pedestal. And, you know, then you've got people like, you know, a silly mayor going out in public and making a fool of herself, or a cabinet minister who has stress going in her life, and she gets drunk and crashes her car and then flees the scene. Or you've got somebody who's on charges for shoplifting. So, you know, but then the coverage is all about, oh, poor thing. Oh, we have to feel sorry for her. Oh, she's so stressed. She's so stressed out. And, you know, it's really difficult. And people do things out of character. So we've got the Woke Sympathy Award. And then I think the best award is probably the Blind Journalism Award, or the award for not questioning the obviously questionable. And I think that could be applied to a lot of media coverage that you see, and notably that I can think of some examples just this week of that. But I thought perhaps we could have fun with these, with awarding these awards.
Well, you know, on that one about the questioning award, there's that strange decision that this week, the story about the 13-year-old boy who died 10 days after he'd had an injection. And the coroner came out and said that he may have died from it, but there's not enough evidence. Guy Hatchard came out and said there's more than enough information to make that ruling, and the government's hiding the data that would help us make our own minds up. Why aren't the journalists asking more questions about this one?
Well, very good, but you know, we've seen this over the last 4 years now, and in the Parliament protest, we had journalists who stood in front of an ocean of placards saying "End the mandates," and proclaimed to the public, "Oh, what did these people? What is it that they're protesting about?" So there's lots of examples of blind journalism, but that matter that you're referring to is a particularly sad one, because I think the ruling was that a determination of certainty couldn't be made that the mRNA jab was the cause of this young person, a 13-year-old, fit, active, otherwise healthy, young lad, and the ruling was that it couldn't be determined whether it was actually the mRNA jab or virus, and there was some coverage about virus particles. Well, you know, the obvious question was, well, then did the boy have his vaccine when he also had the virus. How does virus particles come into it? But there was no questioning of that. It was just stated in the media, this was the decision, and there was no commentary about it, no questioning, nothing. I don't think it even got mentioned on the TVNZ news. It was just announced as a decision, no questioning, off it went.
But of course, they did have a lot of other things to talk about this week. And one of those things was, and I hate to call it a conspiracy theory, but it seems to me like it might be one. There was the story about the Auckland University and their Maori and Pacifica Safe Spaces sign. Apparently, there was a sign that locked off this area, this safe space for students of those two ethnicities. And then someone from ACT and also Winston Peters, they made comments about how inappropriate segregation is. And then the sign mysteriously disappeared. So the media lashed out. They reported Willie Jackson calling people idiots, cultural groups calling us all racist, etc., etc., before the university clarified that they'd taken the sign away to get it written up in Maori as well. It seems to me that maybe the media is engaging in a little bit of conspiracy theories, and maybe that's why they were too busy to report on the COVID-19 vaccine death.
Alistair, one of the things that fascinated me about that was that nobody seemed to ask the question, how long has this been going on for? And I can tell you that it has been going on for a long time. I can recall when I was at university, and I'm talking about the 1960s, there were common rooms that were set up for various groups. And nobody seemed to worry too much that Māori and Pacifica, although there weren't that many Pacifica students when I was there, had a particular space, and various other organisations had a particular space, and the ladies had a particular space. So what? Really? You know, you have clubs and stuff like that. What a fuss. I was absolutely astonished because... You know, the impression that I got from the news media was, this is new. It's not. This is wrong. Well, why is it wrong? Please explain to me. And to sort of say, oh, racism, rubbish, apartheid, rubbish. You know, groups of people are perfectly entitled to have a space that they gather in. Not a problem. You know, move on. Really?
It's interesting the way that you say that. I've never thought of that before. The difference here is semantics. You use the word common room. They're using the word safe space. It's an ideological argument, is it not?
It could well be. I mean, a common room is a room in common for a particular group of people. I mean, we use the same term in the judiciary, where judges gather to have a cup of coffee. It's called the common room. I mean, it goes all the way back to university and educational institutions and things like that. It is a common space for a particular group of people. Judges' common rooms are not available for members of the court staff or for the lawyers. It's for judges only. Ooh, that's discriminatory. Wow, we shouldn't have that, should we?
Well, when I was at school, we had a prefect's room, so that would definitely be regarded as highly discriminatory now.
On a prefect's common room, of course. Yeah, we toast and tea, and the rest of the plebs couldn't get any.
Anyway, that particular item of news won my Creating Community Hysteria Award for this week.
Well, and I would agree with you, Catherine. But Alistair, it may well be a matter of semantics. I describe it as a common room, and I would continue to describe it as a common room. I don't go along with the safe space business because life isn't risk-free. And there is a risk in everything.
Just using that word safe there implies some sort of risk, whereas a common room is a completely non-threatening phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. But Alistair, life is a risk. Getting up in the morning is a risk. You know, going down, for me at my age, going downstairs is a risk, for crying out loud. I went out my door at 5 o'clock this morning to go down to the pool. It was pitch black. That was a risk. You know, I sort of trusted in my own ability to manage my way down the path to my car so that I could go to the pool. Come on!
Okay.
Well, life without risk is not worth living.
Well, apparently crossing a rainbow pedestrian crossing is a great risk. You might get splashed with white paint.
Well, the problem is if you expect to be safe on a rainbow crossing, you're not. Because it's not a pedestrian crossing as defined by the traffic regulations, which says that a pedestrian crossing has to be white stripes. And, you know, and if you're on a pedestrian crossing with white stripes, you can expect the car that's coming down the road is going to stop. That's fine. That's what the law says. But if it hits you while you're on a rainbow crossing, well, you know, that would be a different matter altogether because it's not a pedestrian crossing as defined by law.
You're also, if you're going to talk about that story, you're also risking Catherine's Mass Hysteria Award for the week, surely, aren't you? I mean, what's the big hysteria about painting over rainbow crossings? I remember at the Posey Parker incident, they painted over a whole woman's face, didn't they?
Tomato sauce or something.
Yes, indeed. A can of tomato sauce. Actually, I was going to mention that because discussion about the rainbow crossings actually was last week, I think. There was a panel discussion on Radio New Zealand with Wallace Chapman. And it was mentioned, and they had Professor Peter Lynham on the panel, who talked about how heartbroken he was about this white paint on the rainbow crossing. And the thing that fascinated me about that discussion was that the panelists agreed that this was a heinous crime. Now, you know, I mean, when does the presenter of such programs step in and say, hang on a minute, a heinous crime? I think the definition of a heinous crime is something really evil and horrible. But what are you talking about? You know, somebody's splashing paint around and that's a heinous crime? But it's
intentional damage. It's an offence under the Summary Offences Act, for heaven's sake.
Well, it's but why is tipping a can of tomato sauce over a person? Why is that not a heinous crime?
Well, if it took place, that's an assault.
But I think, you know, this is where the responsibility of the news media and TV and radio presenters seems to be completely missing. Nobody says, hang on a minute, aren't you overdoing the woke sympathy just a tad beyond reasonable?
Well, the funny thing about all of this, and I think a lot of people seem to have missed it entirely, is that a rainbow crossing, in fact, is white. Because all a rainbow is a diffusion of white light. It's white light that's put through a prism, and it divides up into all sorts of different wavelengths. And that's what it is. Frankly, you know, putting to one side all of the political implications and so on and so forth, I think rainbow crossings are beautiful because they're colourful and they give some life to that particular space, because there's nothing worse than a strip of asphalt, really. I mean, it's ghastly. So isn't it nice to have a little bit of white light diffused through a prism cast upon the roadway? Of course, the irony is that by putting white paint over it, you're taking it back to its original form. Because it used to be white before they put it through the prism. Go for it.
I don't think there's much we can argue with about that one, David.
Yeah, I've got Newton to back me on this one.
The other thing that we can't argue with is that we have run out of time, so we're going to leave it there for another week. David, thank you very much for your time this week.
Thank you, Alistair. It's been a pleasure.
And Catherine, it's been great to catch up with you again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So that's all we have time for this week on The Fourth Estate. I'd like to thank all our RCR listeners for joining us this week and listening in and supporting free and independent media. I wish you a very happy Friday and a wonderful weekend ahead. My name is Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to The Fourth Estate only on Reality Check Radio.